Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
A lot of the people who had felt like outsiders at that time in 1990 now being manipulated by people who want power. Everything has changed between 1990 and now, and yet nothing has changed.
Welcome all, it is episode 102 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is The Athletic Merseyside football reporter Simon Hughes. Simon is also the author of several excellent books, including There She Goes, which is a social history of the city of Liverpool, and he's also written a number of excellent books about Liverpool Football Club, including a trilogy of sorts of player stories from the 1980s, 1990s and 2000s. We figured, with the European Cup final this weekend, it would be a pretty good time to chat to Simon about all things Liverpool, Merseyside and further afield. Do get in touch with us. You can email gavincooney@the42.ie. Tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. It is in that WhatsApp group that you can trade reading recommendations with like-minded fans of this show, and also submit questions for future guests, as so many of you did for Simon. So a few of those questions are in this conversation, so let's get on with it. The Behind the Lines edition with Simon Hughes. Simon Hughes, thank you so much for doing the podcast. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, Gavin. No problem.
So, I'm guessing this Liverpool schedule as we at the end of the season is exhausting for the players, but how exhausting has it been for the journalists?
Thanks for asking that question. It's not one we often get asked. It hasn't been too bad for me personally, because I'm not expected to cover every single match. If you were to ask James Pearce, my colleague, he'd probably give you a different answer. I mean, my role now is more away from the matches, really, fewer match reports, which is what I wanted to do when I first set out in journalism, really. Although I've been at most of the home matches and quite a few of the aways in the finals, I haven't had that immediate deadline pressure on me during matches, so I have actually been able to enjoy some of them, even as a fan sometimes. So yeah, I mean, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, when they were in the Champions League and going for the league title, similar situation to now. I was thinking, I'm on this treadmill here of preview, match report, follow up, and it was just like that for several months, and it was draining. But this summer, I am looking forward to a holiday. Nevertheless, I will not lie about that.
Have you been in the press box then this season for those games you mentioned, or have you been among the supporters?
Not so much, really. Only on a couple of occasions. So yeah, it's been, I'll admit it, it's been quite liberating, really, because I think that sometimes when you are in the press box, it's although it's obviously a privileged place to be sitting, and I do enjoy it. I do find that you can. I know I have, anyway, lost sight of sort of the drama around you to some degree. It's important, I think, sometimes to be able to let a bit of that into your writing. I've only been a couple of times this season. And I'll be honest, I think long may that continue, really. When I first started the Athletic, one of the big attractions was the freedom to go and write about other things, really. And as I said to you before, I think when I was on the cycle of sort of match-led coverage, I did find myself questioning a lot. Like, am I actually offering readers something that they don't already know? Is it just my impression of events, which is obviously important? But when so many people are doing that thing, I did find myself questioning, that there must be more to this. And thankfully, I now have the freedom to go and sort of write a bit more broadly, I'd say. But that brings on its own challenges and stresses as well, because you've got to do it properly, and you've got to make sure that you're on the phone a lot during the week and meeting people. But I do enjoy it.
Yeah. So what's your ask then? Because the ask, if you're in the press box and on the treadmill, as you refer to it as, your objectives are pretty clear. But what are you being asked to do then, in exchange for this more liberating experience?
Yeah, well, it's more feature-led, more investigation-led, if you like, try and get interviews. Obviously, not have coverage that's just totally centered around the match. I do understand that obviously football sort of amounts to the matches, but there's only so much that you can report that's different around that match, particularly with the time pressures that people are working against. So during the week, I mean, I'll have three or four things that I'll be working on at any one time, which will be working towards a 2 or 3 week cycle. It's stuff that can be written in longer form. So I'm just trying to think of the best example of this season. I'm not giving a very good answer here, but for example, a few weeks ago, that Merseyside Derby did a big piece on sort of the academy situations at Liverpool and Everton and what has happened, where it's all heading. I mean, I wouldn't have had the time to put the calls in to do that piece if it was on the cycle of matches. And obviously a lot of people read that piece, a lot of people subscribed off the back of it. You know, that's just an example of it, really. So it's sort of looking really at what's going on, and it obviously leaves a bit more room for unexpected news as well, you know, and looking for news lines which you can work towards and try and get the inside track on. So, I mean, I'd say it's more investigative than the work that I was doing previously, and trying to get to the root of the issues that are affecting football on Merseyside.
So we are recording this, listener, before the final day of the Premier League season. I know you're listening to it after it, so you have the benefit of knowing who has won the Premier League, as we can't talk about that really. But regardless, I mean, as we sit here, Simon, heading into the final day of the Premier League season with Liverpool a point behind City, and then in the Champions League final on Saturday, and with two cups already in the bag, can you assess this Liverpool squad and this Liverpool season? I mean, is this as good as it has ever been?
Certainly in my lifetime, yeah. So that is, when I say like my lifetime, that from what I can remember, the starting point, which is 1990, really, which is a bad time to start when you think, you know, that was the last time they won the league title before 2020. So, I suppose you assess it against football history. I mean, no team has got this close to the quadruple before. And Liverpool have taken it all away in all competitions. They've been absolutely incredible. I just worry they might regret some of the points that they dropped earlier on in the season, which I thought might be crucial at the time, because I think you can draw a line under what happened last season, where obviously literally everything could go wrong did go wrong. You know, football being played in very strange surroundings, and it certainly didn't suit Liverpool. And I just felt at the start of the season, you know, they started off well, the best players were performing well, they improved in the squad. You know, I think the addition of Luis Diaz has been inspired by the decision makers at the club. I think he's really injected the whole season with the sort of spice that was needed to push the team forward at that time. So, what I would say is, I mean, there haven't been many sort of performances that blow you away and say, "Oh my God, wow!" But they have been either 7, 8, or 9 out of 10, pretty much most weeks. You know, the quality and the relentlessness, that word that just keeps coming up when you talk about Liverpool, has been there, and they've known when to, you know, to put the foot on the throat and known when to ease off. And I think this Liverpool team is definitely up there with any of the teams that went before that 1990 period, because they were never able to reach this point. If they were to get over the line in all the competitions, I mean, God, I mean, it doesn't even bear thinking about what is going to happen in the city over the summer. I'm trying not to think about it too much, because it would be, well, it's obviously unprecedented. Let's just see.
We know how well run the club is now. You know, we've read about sporting director Michael Edwards and his deputy Julian Ward and all the people behind the scenes and all those little marginal gains that the club is getting, and we know how good the players are. But like, none of this happens without Jurgen Klopp, does it?
No, No, well, I mean, Liverpool's the club, isn't it, that I think really led to the rise of the cult of the manager. When you think, you know, Bill Shankly was the one who changed the way football clubs really were run. You know, a lot of football clubs used to be run by committee. Certainly it was at Liverpool, and then he managed to change that formula, and he then took pretty much all of the power into his hands. And I think when Jürgen Klopp took over, it needed that to happen. I think it needed that figurehead, that person to basically lead the club. Because as Liverpool's manager, you're not just the manager of a club. And I don't want to discount Evertonians in this, but you're managing the emotions of a city as well, you know, and having to deal with maybe a lot of politics, social issues that might be beyond the capabilities of a lot of managers, really. And I wouldn't say Klopp is necessarily an expert on everything Liverpool, you know, in terms of Liverpool Football Club's history, Liverpool's history as a city, but he is well informed and is able to balance his knowledge with his own instinct to think of what he thinks right. You know, I think that's really important as well, that he's done things his own way and at times challenged, you know, Liverpool's fan base, you know, particularly in the early days. I think that was really important. That's just the starting point, isn't it? I mean, everything that he's done year on year on year, Liverpool got better every single year under his management. Okay, that the one season in a pandemic when there were no fans and Liverpool had absolutely horrendous injury problems didn't go well. But year on year, he's made every single season, really, the last game mean something, which I think from the fan base's point of view, that's what makes it so exciting. It means that, you know, the heading towards the end of May, there's something that could really be very exciting. It might happen. That's happened every season under Klopp. So I think that's how I'd describe him. He makes things exciting, and the expected outcome isn't always the outcome. He's done an incredible job. I mean, I would compare it. I don't think it's too extreme to say. I think I would compare it to Shankly, although Liverpool were obviously a much bigger club at the point when Klopp inherited the challenge. I think that some of the challenges of managing a club the size of Liverpool were greater than what Shankly had to deal with, you know, in terms of there was a lot of frustration at Liverpool in the late 50s, but it wasn't the club that it is now. You know, he's had to take on the pressures of a global club, and which are often made quite acute by, you know, the local fan base, and quite rightly as well, you know, that is the way it is, and has had to inherit as well all the sort of social issues that Liverpool faces going back decades. So, he has done, I think that in Liverpool's history, he's in keeping with the manager that everybody says changed the course of Liverpool's direction as a whole.
I assume you've been asked this question 50,000 times since he was appointed in 2015, but sadly, here it is for a 50,000 and first time. What's he like?
I don't think he's changed much, really, from since that first day. I remember I was there when he was appointed, and we sat down with him in the Centenary Stand / Kenny Dalglish Stand, as it is now, because the main stand was being rebuilt at the time. And I think we had about 15 minutes with him. You know, he's very persuasive. I will say straight away, as soon as he started to talk, I thought, well, I believe him straight away. Very good salesman. Very, you know, just physically, he's much, much taller than people think. I think that actually counts for a lot, you know, when you're a football manager, because there's an element, I'd say there's an element of threat with him as well. I mean that in a positive way. You know, I've been on the receiving ends of his fury this season, And it's not a it's not a nice position to be in. But I'd imagine if you're a football player, I mean, a lot of the players say this, that they want to please him, really, in the way that they want to please their own fathers. He's got that sort of demeanour about him. You know, I certainly don't know him socially, but people who do know him socially enjoy his company as well. I think he is able to switch off from that you know, the pressures of his job, which I think is important. He comes across to me as quite, you know, well-rounded individual, but like all managers, you know, there's an element of madness with all managers, particularly, you know, successful ones. I think you've got to think differently. You've obviously got to have a huge amount of belief in yourself, because if you don't believe yourself, nobody's going to believe in you. But yeah, he's just got that magnetism that everybody says he has, and more when you meet him. Obviously, when he's on TV, you see more of sort of the jovial, sometimes avuncular type character. I think you see less of that behind the cameras, but I think that's, again, a way that he likes to interact with the media. I think he's very clever at knowing when to act in a certain way. But equally, you know, sometimes people see the sort of the more aggressive side when he gets angry about certain things have happened. I think that's just him. I think it's fair. I always remember that, I think it was a game in his first season, and Liverpool, I think Liverpool had beaten Dortmund. I think it was that game, and you could hear him down the tunnel before you actually saw him. You know, he's almost like was able to compartmentalise the game that had just happened and the madness before he'd gone into the press room. And I was thinking, how do people do that? You know, you've just gone from one situation to another. You've got to then come across quite calm. I think he's good at doing that, but no one's perfect, are they? I think that's what people like about him, is that he's imperfect. I think particularly Liverpool people would admit, you know, that you know, everybody's imperfect, and I think that's what makes him more relatable, really.
Can you tell us, what did you do to provoke his fury this season?
Well, it was indirectly. I mean, some people have probably seen some of the clips. He was a bit upset about an article that another newspaper had, I don't say this lightly, pretty much ripped off what we'd written and twisted the words in it. He got angry about what we'd written, even though he was quoting what had been written in the other newspaper's report. So when I say I felt his wrath, I wasn't there. I've actually felt the wrath of people online who obviously believed everything that he said that day. Because let's face it, Jürgen Klopp could say what he wants and everybody's always going to believe him. I think he actually got it wrong that day when he said what he did. I don't know how to what extent he was misinformed or what, but we were being accused of writing something that we hadn't, basically. So yeah, I certainly know how popular he is, because if somebody's going to believe a journalist over Jürgen Klopp, it's just never going to happen, basically, is it?
How did you become a journalist? Was it always football that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I mean, I started off writing for the local papers in Liverpool, covering non-league football team called Marine, who sure a lot of people will recognise now because they played Tottenham in the FA Cup last year. I was reporting on them about 20 years ago, sort of by accident, really. I mean, I know it sounds a bit of a cliche, doesn't it? But I used to go to quite a few of the games, and I had some interest in writing. And one of the guy who did most of the coverage had been packed off to write about another sports team one weekend. And he just said, do you fancy filling in for me? And I did it and got pretty much everything wrong. But over the years, managed to sort of develop my understanding of actually what needed to happen. Because it's not just about writing, it's about developing relationships. And I mean, the most important thing is contacts more than anything else. So I lived in Crosby, where Marina based. So it was pretty straightforward gig. But you know, a lot of it was unpaid work for a long time. I mean, what I would say is that I did quite a lot of general news as well. for the local papers, and that was really important. Really, I'd say that was just as important as any sports reporting I've done, because that made me understand really the structure of a story, how to really get to a point as quickly as possible, even if you're doing the sort of long read writing that I do now.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit about that, getting to, because that's an interesting challenge. Like, how do you get to a point succinctly when you're at the same time tasked with writing about it in, you know, multiple thousands of words?
Well, I just always think that, you know, that within the introduction, the most interesting part of the story has to be there, essentially. It's as simple as that. And then you obviously have to then sort of explain how that interesting element of that story came to pass. Although The Athletic specializes in long read reporting, as far as I'm concerned, they only work if it's worth writing about, you know. But obviously it goes back to why, I suppose, some of the frustrations that I had working for some of the newspapers is obviously constricted by space. If you're in a newspaper and online as well, whereas The Athletic was like, no, we'll give each story, you know, the room to breathe. And having written a couple of books, you know, I did appreciate the value in that. It's a very basic thing, but the most interesting elements of the story, stuff that you have to try and find a way, in a creative way, to tell people something they don't already know, as high up in the story as possible, to capture their attention. You know, that just doesn't change no matter how much, you know, how big your word count is or how small it is.
Let's talk about books then. You've picked a couple for us. First of all Played Out by Pete Davis.
Yeah, well, when I was finishing university, I read this book. I saw a review of it in 442, who I think actually serialized part of the book. Obviously, the book is about a journalist who is a non-sports writer who goes to the World Cup in 1990 and basically spends a month following the World Cup around Italy. So it's part travelogue as well, which is something that I've always enjoyed. But it's obviously centered around this huge football tournament at a time when, you know, the game is changing. I think it's fair to say that Italia 90 changed a lot about football. It was already changing, but, you know, there's a lot of stories from that World Cup, which I'm sure in Ireland as well. I mean, obviously, you don't need me to tell you how Ireland did in 1990. So it was an incredible World Cup, which I can remember as well. I could remember that. It was the first World Cup. Although I'm not a supporter of... I'm certainly not an England fan, put it that way. I think that's the easiest way to say it. But I have always loved World Cups, despite that. Even though sometimes the football isn't as high quality as we've seen in certainly the Premier League over the last 10, 15 years, I just love something about the dynamic of it, particularly when it's in a country with a strong identity. And at that time, Italy was the place to be, you know, in terms of football. You know, all the best players were there. The best teams came out of Italy. So for me, it was my entry point it was my entry point into football, really. I mean, I was 6, 7 when that tournament happened. So obviously, I had this sort of thing about the 1990 World Cup, and then I saw this book and I started reading it. I just started reporting on football, and it ties into how I feel now about reporting and why I work for The Athletic, because it's a form really of long form writing, you know, writing about the sort of social aspects of the game within football. You know, it's more, I suppose, than, dare I say, going into a press box every week and reporting what you see from that position. There's certainly more to it than that. I'm not saying that people who just go to a press box, that's all they do. Clearly they don't, but there is more to it than that. So, it's just a brilliant book. Pete Davis, who have subsequently sort of got to know really through a colleague who wrote a follow-up to that book, which is a really, really, really good book as well, which I'd recommend, by Simon Hart, called World in Motion. He did like a follow-up to this book where he went round all the, you know, the countries that sort of featured in the World Cup and spoke to people about the impact that it actually had. So that's a really, really good follow-up. I'd certainly recommend that to anyone who's interested in it. But for me, it sort of really illustrate, for me, when I read the book, I thought that's what I'd like to do at some point. I'd love to do something similar to this, where you can go to a tournament or cover a football team and write about stuff that isn't necessarily just about the matches. It's, you know, that obviously the matches are hugely important and need its coverage, but there is more to football reporting than just matches, I think. And I don't think anybody did it better, really, because Pete Davis, the author, as I said, was not a football reporter. He was a football fan, but went to Italy at an unprecedented time, really, where he also had access to the England team and Bobby Robson. I mean, that is never going to happen again. You know, so I think that element to it as well, he managed to get the access and then still tell the other side of it and be critical of what was going on to some degree as well. It's just a brilliant book. And anyone, particularly from an Ireland perspective as well, there's lots of Ireland-related content in there, which I'm sure, you know, people have read the book in Ireland, but it's to anybody who hasn't, I'd say read it, because if a book sums up sort of football at a crossroads, at a point that it is heading towards it is now, it's certainly this book.
So you mentioned the social aspect of football there, and it's evident in the ambiguity of the title, because Pete Davis gave an interview to the Irish Times a couple of years ago, and he was asked about that title. I've got the quote here, I'll read it out, and if you have a reaction to it, you have a reaction to it. There was a grief there, he says. I grieve for what has happened to my country. All the shit that is going on in England now, this is in 2020, has been coming for a long time, and you could see the seeds of it in 1990. At the end of the tournament, you could walk away and say, I've had a great time, I've been so lucky, what a spectacle. But the fuckwits were still out there. And what was a hooligan element back then has flourished in the decades since to take over Westminster. What is Brexit only political hooliganism? It's not only the stupidest thing a country ever did, it's also malevolent and belligerent. It's kicking in your own windows on a continental scale. I grieve for England. I'm not trying to make myself out to be prescient or prophetic, but I felt it then. That was what all played out meant. You felt it and saw it recurring over and over again. You were feeling good about things and then some fucking idiot shows up and ruins it. Be it a guy throwing a bottle at the police or one of the tabloids stitching up a player, whatever. What is this culture? Football is a window into a country's soul.
That's pretty powerful, and I'd agree with a lot of that. It's certainly not a triumphant book. I think after that World Cup, obviously, there was an element of triumphalism about England, despite getting knocked out in a World Cup semi-final. There was this sort of feeling that football was fine again, that it was okay to like, that it wasn't riddled by all the things that Pete spoke about there. Whereas in his book, I think, if you read back now, you know, it's certainly really wasn't like that. That feeling was only came and was temporary because of the supposed success of the England team. So it hid a lot of the problems, and then the acceleration and popularity of football didn't make those problems go away. It just hid them for a long time. You know, the sort of the violent elements of British culture, and they lay hidden. A lot of the people, I would say, who, you know, you mentioned hooligans, you know, so there's this impression of football hooliganism for a long time. I'd left the terraces of England. Obviously, we only saw last night what happened at Nottingham Forest, where a player gets headbutted by a fan. That's not an isolated incident this season. And I know Pete speaks about the malevolent forces. A lot of these forces are just lay hidden and dormant for a long time. They haven't gone away. And they were certainly visible. When you read that book, they're certainly visible. The poisonous elements of it, with particularly the reporting of it as well. I mean, I remember I read this book when I was in university. So this is 14, 15 years after the book was published. And one of my lecturers at university, whose name I will not mention, who was a lecturer I actually respected, is name checked in the book. And he's sort of outed, really, as in the book, as being one of the the reporters, tabloidy type reporters, who, shall we say, was being irresponsible with some of his reporting and the methods around his reporting at that tournament. So I had respected him until this point. And I remember speaking to him about it and saying, you know, what do you have to say about that? And he was still furious. And subsequently, his attitude towards me did change. And his, you know, I studied in Sheffield. I later found he made some, this lecturer actually made some comments about Hillsborough to me afterwards, which I wish I could go back to him now and say, you know, you're wrong. So 15 years later, as I said, he was still harbouring those same sort of attitudes, really. And I think whereas a lot of the people who Pete's talking about there had felt like outsiders at that time in 1990, they've now been manipulated by people who want power, basically, which has come in the form of Brexit. So, yeah, I mean, it feels like basically everything has changed between 1990 and now, and yet nothing has changed.
Your second book, As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning by Laurie Lee. Can you tell us about this? Because I will hold my hands up and say I don't know anything about it.
Right, so there's a couple of strands to this. I mean, I first read this book as an adult, and I was going around Spain for 2 weeks. Basically, I was in between jobs, trying to think about my next move. Wasn't really sure what to do. And a colleague said, oh, if you're going around Spain, you should read this book, Laurie Lee's As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. He basically walks through Spain just before the Civil War in the 1930s. And I read the book, and again, it's the reportage of what happens. It's quite a journalistic book, really, although it's written as an account of what he saw on this journey. So it's, again, a travelogue, really, of a period of great change in Spain, a country which I loved and came to love through football, really. I think when I was growing up, my impression of Spain really was the Costas. I didn't see anything different. And then my attitude certainly changed around the time when, obviously, Liverpool, taken over by a Spanish manager, signed a lot of Spanish players, was afforded really amazing opportunities when Fernando Torres signed for Liverpool, was sent out to Madrid to do some special reporting with his family, his friends, all that sort of thing. And I realised then that Spain is such a fascinating country, you know, which is has lots of different people with different attitudes, very acute sense of regionalism, and just fell in love with it. And I've since been around Spain, you know, pretty much everywhere. I would go as much as possible. But when I read this book, it sort of just really brought to life sort of what I already knew, but a lot of stuff that I didn't know as well. And it's basically Laurie Lee's account of walking out of his house in Gloucestershire one morning to London, and then getting the ferry to Vigo and walking all the way to the south of Spain, and documenting his feeling around the land, the people, the politics, and what was to come as well. And it's the way he writes. I mean, his writing's just, you know, beautiful, really. There's no other way to describe it. He just makes it such an easy read.
What did it bring to life, or recognition that you knew already?
In terms of Spain, you mean?
Yeah, or however you want to interpret it, because you did say it brought something to recognition, that things that you knew and things you didn't know.
Yeah, well, as I said, those sort of earliest trips to cover football in Spain and football issues around Spain, I just realised that there's far more going on here. There's strong views and deep history. But I'd never read a book which actually brought a lot of that to life. You know, a lot of it would have been through reporting in newspapers, short reporting, whereas this sort of shows the timelessness of Spain, I'd say, the land itself. You know, not much not in a lot of places in Spain, not much has changed for a long time. And I think reading this book, it's obviously in the 1930s, true story. It made me realise that I could identify with a lot of the stuff that I've seen over the last 15 years when I've travelled around the country. I could see that a lot hasn't changed. And I actually found that quite reassuring in some ways. And it's just a country that I love, the food, the drink, you know, the football culture, you know, the general culture, you know, everything about it is just for me, really.
And when you talk about the regionalism that it talks about, I mean, is that analogous with your experience of your own city? You did say earlier on in this podcast that you're not an England fan.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, because I mean, Liverpool, as people know, does feel very separate from the rest of the country. Although, you know, there are a lot of people talking about it this week about, you know, the booing of the national anthem. I mean, I'm shocked at people's surprise, really. I mean, it's happened on several occasions the last few years. It's almost like the Charity Shield in 2019 didn't happen. And that there are good reasons why, very good reasons why that is happening. And I'd rather people, you know, show more willingness to listen as to why, rather than just condemn it. You know, I wrote a book about Liverpool in the 1980s, which is a decade that I grew up in. So I didn't attempt to sort of obviously try and convince people that I was there because I can't remember it. But I tried to approach that book by writing it in a sort of journalistic way and try and attempt to explain why Liverpool feels the way it does about itself and why people feel about Liverpool in the way that it is, whilst also trying to analyse actually what happened to Liverpool in that decade and maybe dispel and confirm some of the myths along the way. Whereas, you know, I think we've seen over the, certainly it feels like the attitudes toward the city are hardening again. This is before the booing of the national anthem. So I think it's a city that feels misunderstood. And you certainly feel that, in, you know, when you walk around, I haven't walked around Spain like Laurie Lee, but I've travelled around Spain. You certainly feel that way about Spain when you travel around a lot of places. It still doesn't feel quite connected in a lot of ways. You know, it still feels quite fragmented. I think, obviously, that is the outcome of the Civil War, really. People feel very different, you know, wherever you go, really. But I also equally think that is part of its beauty, really, that it does have that sense of place. Each place should feel different. I don't see why people are so scared by that in this country, really. I think Liverpool is a place in itself. Everywhere is different. That's not to say that Liverpool is exceptionally, you know, different to anywhere else. It is a different place. Just as Barcelona has different politics and Catalonia has different feelings to Liverpool. I think people like to sort of sometimes say, well, Liverpool's like Naples. It's a bit like Boston. So people sort of, you know, will identify with all that. But there's always lots of differences wherever you go. And certainly across Spain, you know, you could go to two towns less than 10 miles from each other and they will have slightly different cultures. It's sort of up to you to try and figure out those subtleties, I think.
We got a load of listener questions in for you, Simon, and I think this one by Phil kind of fits relatively neatly in this part of the conversation. Phil says, Simon does great work covering the fan aspect of Liverpool as well as the non-league and local football scene in the city. How does he feel the working class left-leaning ethos of the fan base and the city sits alongside owners who try to trademark the name of the city, referring to FSG, the owners of Liverpool?
It doesn't. There's a simple answer to that. It just doesn't. I think that it doesn't, but I do think that the owners realise its presence, which is important, because I'd say that some owners don't. They don't realise, you know, what they're dealing with. But I think the reason why Liverpool have been successful is because the owners have, to some extent, accepted that and have tried to understand it more. Because I think when things harness together at Liverpool, it's a very powerful and difficult momentum to stop. But it only takes one decision to upset that sort of balance, really. You know, you mentioned the trademark and attempts. You know, more recently, we've had NFT, crypto. I know people have got different views on this, that and the other about it. But yeah, I mean, I think FSG have been responsible owners of Liverpool. I mean, they've treated the club itself with great financial respect, I'd say, and tried to ensure that the club certainly doesn't go down a path that it had gone down under the previous ownership. But, you know, you can't just judge everything by sort of people's worst efforts, can you? You know, you've got to look forward. And I think that the club is making more effort in recent years to sort of align itself with the fans' interests. But I'm just always waiting for the next thing that they get wrong. I'll be honest. I think it's a constant battle, really. It'll be a constant battle forever. It'll never, from the fans' perspective, the local fans' perspective, it'll never be over. They will continue to have to fight their corner. While this is the arrangement, unfortunately.
And it's not, I mean, it's not just the reality for Liverpool, it's the reality for, you know, so many English clubs, that it's such a delicate balancing act, because the ethos of the clubs, which give that give the club its identity, is in conflict with the economics of the club that it needs to operate under to maintain, to be successful on the pitch.
Yeah. It is, yeah. And on those sort of rare periods where the interests fuse, as I said, it can be irresistible, but it doesn't take very much for things to be upset, really. I just think that, you know, I get frustrated just personally when you see in certain situations when the club sells itself off that image, but then you see certain things eroding from beneath that go against what makes the club potentially, which makes the club different, really. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say that within sort of the local community, in terms of its responsibility to Anfield, that they've been good, really. You know, I speak to people in Anfield. I mean, they've improved the match day experience of people who live there, I'd say, by making sure that, you know, around the rebuilds of the stands, and obviously there's a new one to come. You know, Anfield around the area is a smarter place than it was, and finding a solution to the stadium issue was something to plague Liverpool for a long time. I actually don't think that the owners get enough credit for that, really, even being totally honest. That's, you know, that's not me saying that, you know, my effort. I just see things for what they are. I'm neither an FSG supporter or a critic. I think they need to be judged on the individual decisions that they make. If in an ideal world, I'd sooner the football wasn't, you know, a challenge between oil states, murderous regimes, and the venture capitalists being the good guys in it all. It just sort of just says, you know, says a lot, really, about the state of the game. Mm. But, you know, there are certainly different variations of bad. I use that word bad carefully, but I have just said it, so there you go. But I think that they have been good for Liverpool based on the wider environment of football, which obviously people are unable to control at this moment. It'll be interesting to see, because if Liverpool, I always think, you know, it's just when Liverpool start getting things right on the pitch, that's when they try and capitalise on that popularity and monetise the situation, which is when the challenges start again. So if Liverpool did win the quadruple, I would not be surprised if there was another public challenge from the fan base just around the corner.
Mm. Pick number three. What is it?
Oh, number three. Right, okay. So 43 years with the same bird by Brian Reid. Maybe some people have mentioned this on the podcast before, but
no, it's a first. We're 102 episodes in, and Pete Davis has got one previous mention. Laurie Lee, right. You'll be surprised to hear, didn't get a mention before, and Brian Reid hasn't.
Oh, I'm surprised. I mean, I know Brian personally, and I love him to bits. He's a great guy. A reporter who I respect massively. But to be honest, when I first read this book, I didn't know him. So I'm certainly not judging him on that. And I just think, particularly from a Liverpool perspective, I think, again, it's not just a football story, this. It's obviously Brian's story from growing up in Liverpool in the 60s to, I think, a point maybe in 2007-08, something like that. I think that's where the period that it covers him. It's his personal account of that journey, really. And obviously it takes in the whole successful period that Liverpool had, you know, the desperate period of the 80s with everything that involves, you know, his own personal challenges of becoming a journalist and trying to balance that with still being a supporter of the club. And he sort of gives up on being a sports reporter for that reason, which, you know, has sent him on a career path, which, again, brilliant what he's done. I just love the story and the way he writes it. You know, he's just very, very sharp. And, goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of this conversation about he sort of, there's never a lost word in his reporting, really. And I'd say that about this book. For anybody who really wants to know what it's like being a Liverpool supporter from the city, from that era, I'd say that's the book to read, really, because... You know, some of the passages are heartbreaking, you know, like obviously reading about Hillsborough, Heysel as well. It's still hard to read now. But yeah, he's a brilliant reporter. And I just think there's a lot of books like this out there about Liverpool, you know, like sort of fan accounts of what it's like being a Liverpool fan. But for me, this one is definitely the best, and it's got the eye of a reporter as well. So he there's that side to it, I think, sort of separates it from the rest of them.
As I said, we got loads of listener questions in for you. We have time for to throw out a couple of them. Aidan Delaney asks, Man City have already laid in a marker for next year by announcing Erling Haaland. With Michael Edwards stepping down as sporting director, will Liverpool be able to keep up the pace next year with the squad they have, or have their summer signings lined up already?
Asking for an exclusive, as he right? Okay,
I think
it's quite a question. I look at the Haaland signing and think, well, why have City signed him? Obviously, a great player. I mean, I can't see it adding to the points totals that City are getting in the Premier League. If I'm being totally honest, I think he's been signed for the Champions League and to give them a better chance in that competition. And in their way, in that competition, invariably, it's going to be Liverpool. And over two games or one game, an isolated game, I'd still fancy Liverpool. So I think it makes Liverpool... I've got to be honest. How do you improve that Liverpool team? It's very hard, isn't it? And the squad as well. I mean, I think they just need to be thinking about... It's not necessarily... what happens next season. It's the season after they need to be thinking about this summer, really, because they've got such great variation in attack. Obviously, one or two players will leave, Origi being one, which I'm a bit disappointed with, really. It's where, if he wanted to stay, I'd just keep him for the factor that he just seems to score when it matters. But, yeah, they've obviously signed Diaz. Let's not forget that. I mean...
But surely they can't afford to lose Mane and Salah. Or even even
one of
them.
Well, no, of course they can't. No, they can't. That's what I'm saying. I think they're going to have to... I think they'll have to sign at least one player in that area, the pitch, this summer, to account for the departure of Origi and potentially one of those two players. Goalkeeper, don't need a goalkeeper. I think they're signing a young fullback, aren't they? Potentially from Aberdeen. Certainly don't need a left back, don't need any centre halves. where do you improve? It's very hard to improve that team. So I do think that they need to be thinking really more about the future with the players that they sign this summer. Because I think that it's going to be very hard to improve what they've got already.
We could also, I assume, have done the full hour on Everton and like what a contrast that is to how Liverpool have been run. We have about 5 minutes. I mean, you don't have to fill them all, but with your thoughts on Everton, just, I mean, very bleak season. It looks like perhaps that they will avoid relegation. I now realise that we are recording this before the Premier League ends, and this is going out after. So I'm sorry, listener, or especially if you're an Everton fan, if they have actually gone down. But I mean, maybe holding that in abeyance, like how directionless is the club, and how long is the road back?
It's a long road back. I mean, it depends. I think the problem with Everton is nobody has ever defines what success is, whether that be in the short term, medium term, long term. I know Mascheri, when he came in, was speaking about the Champions League. But, I mean, for me, I think Everton desperately need to win a trophy at some point. Just eases the pressure on the fan base. I mean, I think you compare it to Liverpool this week. I mean, obviously the fans want to win the league, but now they've won the league, Liverpool, there's not that stress and tension that existed 2 or 3 years ago. It makes things a lot easier once you've got over the line with the thing that you're trying to do. And I think for Everton, there needs to be some cause for success and celebration, because there's a whole generation of young fans, you know, lads my age who... Sorry, maybe not my age. Maybe a few. I'm 38 now, so maybe lads who are entering the 30s who cannot remember Everton winning a trophy, which is appalling for a club of its size. So I think they need to be realistic about it. They need to hold firm in that. They can learn a lot from what's happened at Liverpool, and a lot comes down to the managerial appointments. But I think there hasn't been enough heat on Mascheri, if I'm being totally honest. You know, he's been jumped from idea to idea. I thought the appointment of Benitez was insane, and I wrote that at the time. I just thought it's never going to work. So first of all, he needs to get his decisions right, but they need to make sure that, you know, that whatever they're trying to do, they don't panic at the first sign of things not quite working out. I mean, Mascheri moved heaven and earth to try and get Marco Silva as manager a couple of years ago, and obviously the results turned, and I'm not saying he should have kept him at the time, but I think he has proven that he's a reasonably good manager who has obviously managed to turn Fulham into a team that's gone from losing every week to winning every week and winning in style. So he's always got something about him. But it just seems to me that he makes decisions based on the prevailing mood rather than actually what needs to happen. So, and given that he hasn't really come out and said, well, this is what we're trying to do, you know, and admit that it's going to take time to get there, it gives him that sort of, it makes me think, well, he doesn't really know what he's after. Because it's not easy to win a trophy. It's obviously not easy to do it. Liverpool had to wait 4 years under Klopp to do it. It's not easy to get in the Champions League. So, I just think that at the moment, a lot of things aren't joined up at Everton. They're trying to rescue that. I'd be interested to see the appointment of Kevin Thelwell. You know, they've gone through various sporting directors, jumped from idea to idea. None of it's worked. The academy is obviously I wrote about this a few weeks ago, isn't in a great position. They're behind Liverpool now. So there's a lot of work to do, a lot of work. But... yeah, I think Everton fans are going to have to be quite patient, really, again, which is horrible to say that because, you know, they have been they have been patient for an awful long time. But, you know, I'd be very, very surprised if Everton jump from the position that they're in now to a position that people hope that, or, you know, dream of them being in. You know, in a short space of time, any manager needs time to get things right, and they just haven't given any of the managers time to do that.
Simon Hughes, thank you so much for doing the podcast. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you very much to Simon. Thanks to you as ever for listening to Behind the Lines and supporting what we do here at The 42. It is greatly appreciated. We're back in a fortnight with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.